Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, cleanup continues after a confirmed tornado tore through a nearly 16-mile path from Broome County to Delaware County over the weekend. The state of emergency in the town of Hancock has been lifted, but crews are still clearing debris and restoring power. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar was on the scene. A mural has sparked a debate reaching far beyond one small Catskills community. We'll talk more about the time to unperson controversy and why artists say the dispute raises bigger questions about censorship in public art. An invasive tick species is spreading rapidly across New York, raising new concerns for farmers and vets. Plus, a free dance party in Parksville from our own Ambient Barn, and the second weekend of the Weekend of Chamber Music. After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. A federal appeals court is clearing the way for the release of recorded interviews of former President Biden. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports the Conservative Heritage Foundation had sued for access to the recordings.
The years-old audio recordings contain interviews of Joe Biden by the man who helped ghostwrite his memoir. A prosecutor who investigated Biden's alleged mishandling of classified information later obtained the recordings. That prosecutor, Rob Herr, declined to charge Biden with wrongdoing, saying his age and faulty memory would be obstacles in any criminal case. The Heritage Foundation has been pushing for access to the tapes, and a federal appeals court has found there's a substantial public interest in the recordings. The appeals court in D.C. gave the former president until early August to pursue any additional legal steps. Biden had argued to release the tapes would violate his privacy. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is meeting with Lebanon's president today in Washington as the State Department tries to push forward a peace process between Israel and Lebanon. As NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports, the U.S. is trying to give Lebanon's president a boost.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he thinks it will be a good meeting at the White House, and President Joseph Aoun will be able to return to Lebanon and say he's getting real results for his people, not Hezbollah or Iran. At the moment, Israel controls much of southern Lebanon as it battles the Iranian-backed Hezbollah, which has been firing rockets across the border into Israel. The U.S. has negotiated what are called pilot zones to allow Lebanon to reestablish sovereignty in several areas in the south. Rubio says the U.S. is also talking to Lebanon about international investments and resuming flights from the U.S. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The White House says the newest jet to serve as Air Force One will be taken out of service to undergo upgrades. NPR's Joel Rose reports aviation experts question whether 1 month is enough time for significant changes.
The White House says the newest Air Force One will be out of service for about a month in the fall while it receives, quote, upgrades and enhancements. The Boeing luxury jet was donated by Qatar last year. It was retrofitted so quickly that some aerospace experts say it is not as secure as other Air Force One jets. Richard Abulafia with Aerodynamic Advisory says 1 month isn't enough time to change that.
The idea that anything meaningful could be accomplished in this limited amount of time is somewhat ridiculous. I mean, this is a multi-year process.
Abulafia and others say they were surprised to see the president fly in this plane to a meeting in Turkey earlier this month. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 232 points, the Nasdaq up 195, S&P 500 up 35. You're listening to NPR News. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney is slamming President Trump's imposition of an additional 50% tariff on a range of Canadian goods. Trump says Canada unfairly discriminates against American autos, dairy, and alcohol. The tariffs go into effect in 30 days and range from Canadian wine to hockey sticks to cement. Carney says that violates the USMCA trade agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Earlier this year, Trump said he wouldn't renew that trade agreement. North Korea's foreign minister met with Russia's Vladimir Putin and vowed to further strengthen their alliance. This as Russia and North Korea are growing increasingly critical of the U.S. and its Asian allies. NPR's Se-Woon Gong has more from Seoul.
Foreign Minister Choi Soon-hee said her country will continue to steadfastly support Russia, calling Putin the closest and dearest friend of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. North Korean state media said the two countries discussed key international affairs of mutual interest and added they were aligned on all issues. North Korea has provided Russia with weapons and more than 14,000 troops for its war against Ukraine, according to Ukraine's military intelligence. In the meantime, North Korea has ignored Washington's calls for dialogue and fortified its border with South Korea. Russia's foreign ministry recently criticized South Korea for pursuing defense industrial cooperation with NATO. Seung Gong, NPR News, Seoul.
And I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, investing in creative thinkers and problem solvers who help people, communities, and the planet flourish. More information is available at Hewlett.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for being with us. Communities in and around Hancock, New York are continuing to clean up after an EF1 tornado tore through parts of Broome and Delaware counties Saturday evening. The National Weather Service confirmed the tornado traveled nearly 16 miles from the Sanford area in Broome County toward Hancock in Delaware County. The storm brought winds of up to 95 miles per hour, knocking down trees and power lines and damaging homes and other buildings. The town of Hancock supervisor Jerry Vernald said earlier this morning that the town of Hancock's state of emergency has been lifted effective immediately. But officials are asking for caution as folks travel around and cleanup continues. All roads are open to traffic, but work continues as debris is removed and utilities are restored. Radio Catskill reporter Kimberly Izar found uprooted trees, blocked roads, and widespread power outages as crews continued storm recovery efforts Monday afternoon. And she spoke to the local edition's Patricio Rubio yesterday.
I'll say that, you know, on the main highways, like Route 97 heading north to Hancock and then and County Road 28, the roads are, for the most part, pretty clear. There are some, you know, fallen branches and tree debris kind of along the side of the road. But for the most part, like, travel has kind of resumed since Saturday. It's really when you start venturing off to some of the dirt paths and some of the side roads that things, like, start looking a little bit apocalyptic, to be honest. It was quite scary. I got a tip from one resident who I spoke with briefly that said that, you know, along John Milk Road in Long Eddy, heading up to Hancock, there was significant tree damage. And it was there where, you know, I spoke to one resident. His name was Jim Milk. He lives in the Long Eddy area. And he said that he had never seen anything like the tornado that we witnessed on Saturday. The trees on the road on his way to his house are hemlock trees. So they've been there for at least 200 years. And what I saw was so many of these trees were completely toppled over. The tree roots itself were completely ripped out of the ground. And his grandson was actually flying, you know, like a drone to see the full extent of the damage. And you can see in the actual drone footage that the damage actually goes for at least several hundred yards. So here's Jim recalling the night of the tornado and kind of how he remembers the night.
We heard the tornado alarms go off. Of course, we think, well, we're up in the hills. There's not going to be any tornado around here, right? So we ignored it. And we looked out our window and saw just a wall of rain coming down, coming across. So we went back in the house. Didn't see an actual, like, a tornado or anything. But, boy, my daughter was coming in from North Carolina that night.
On Saturday.
On Saturday, yeah. Oh, and so I tried to get down John Milk Road, and you could see this was completely covered. It was like driving into a bush. It was completely covered over. So then I cut my path up the hill, okay, so that she could come around 28 and come down the hill to the house. Yeah.
Some of the folks that I spoke to have started to resume power, like Jim, who we just heard from. He lost power immediately on Saturday night, and then he told me that he didn't have power pretty much like throughout the whole weekend, but as of this morning at 11 a.m., he finally got power.
Were you able to speak to any of the emergency officials there?
Yeah, I had a chance to speak with the Hancock Fire Chief, Blaze Bojo. he pretty much said that the most significant impact in Hancock happened in the north and eastern parts of Hancock, particularly along Pease Eddy Road, which is a more suburban residential part of the town. Pretty much he said that, you know, after the storm happened, they immediately activated rescue mode operations. There was, you know, like an emergency advisory sent out for the area. There were no non-essential travel during that time. And then since then, it's been lifted and people are back out on the road. But here's some of what Chief Bojo said about the rescue mode operations.
Basically, after the storm hit, we immediately went into rescue mode. So we worked with local DP, the fire department, as the primary agency, worked with local DPW crews, private contractors, and utility companies to start to gain access to the Pease Eddy Road area because we were completely blocked off from there due to downed trees. Once gaining access to that, we started search and rescue operations, searching homes that were damaged, checking on residents, and ensuring that there were no injuries. At that point, we began additional actions to protect life and property, including attempting to clear the road so we could have access for emergency vehicles.
So what should anyone who's traveling through Hancock know before heading out?
I would just keep in mind that there's still a rescue and recovery operations in place. So depending on where you're going in the area, there still might be some fallen trees and some telephone poles. So just go slow while you're on the roads because there still might be stuff and debris along the highways and whatnot. I would also just keep in mind that tomorrow, I believe that there is a severe potential thunderstorm that could be coming to the Hancock, Delaware County area in the afternoon and evening. So one thing that the town supervisor, Vernal, told me is if folks can stay indoors, please stay indoors. Don't get near any trees, and just generally to move with caution if possible.
That's Kimberly Eisauer, who was on the scene yesterday in Hancock, the site of that tornado that came through the area on Saturday evening. And as she mentioned, there are thunderstorms, some heavy, moving through the area this morning and will continue through this evening. Storms can bring flooding, downpours, hail, damaging wind gusts, and potentially an isolated tornado. There are no watches or warnings at this time, though Orange County is under a flash flood watch. And NYSEG is reporting that most power has been restored to residents in the area, with just 26 customers in Broome County without power and 9 in Delaware County without power. Now, a mural in Roscoe that sparked debate over censorship, artistic freedom, and public space continues to generate conversation. The River Reporter's Sonia Ahmed has been covering the story and joins us with an update on what's happened since she's first told us about it and what the controversy says about the role of art in a community. Sonia, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So what are the latest developments surrounding this Time to Unperson mural? And let's remind people what this was, what the controversy is all about.
Yeah. So last year, basically year ago today, what happened is that in Roscoe, this artist, Seth Carnes, he was contracted to paint this mural, which was supposed to read Time to Unperson, on this furniture store, Sunday Home. And unperson, that word in particular, comes from George Orwell's 1984, which, if you don't know, it's a book about this totalitarian government. They are trying to censor things by changing historical documents, news articles, stuff like that. But the phrase really, according to Seth, was open to interpretation. So hence why there were so many different interpretations of it. But later on, as he was painting it, he got to paint to one person. And then as he did that, a member of the community, Phil Vallone, who was former president of Rolling V Bus Corporation, he came up to him and he was like, this mural is going to get painted over. And Seth said, but I was contracted to do this. So the next day, Seth said, okay, I'm going to keep painting. Another man came, said, it's going to get painted over. Eventually, Seth took these threats seriously. He filed a police report. And then from there, it kind of just snowballed. So eventually, the town of Rockland did issue a citation to the building owner of Sunday Home, not the furniture store owners, but the building owner, Daniel. And then from there, Seth filed a legal complaint saying that this violated his artist rights. It went against VERA, which is the Visual Artists' Rights Act. And since then, the mural has now been painted over. He's filed an amended complaint. And more recently, the defense, so Daniel, the building owner, and the town of Rockland have separately filed letters to the judge, which are asking to dismiss the case.
And this has been ongoing over the last year, yes. As you mentioned. Has there been any resolution at all, or is this debate still going on? What's the latest developments?
Yeah, so this debate is definitely still going on. The latest developments would be those letters to dismiss that have been filed. The building owner specifically in that letter argued that the time to unperson mural, the words to unperson, which was what was painted on the building at time of it getting painted over, did not constitute the definition of what's protected under VARA. So they were basically saying that argument is that is not protected under VARA. It's not words of recognized stature. It's not art, basically.
And again, VARA is the Visual Artists' Rights Act, which prohibits destruction of protected artwork. From the artists and others you've spoken with, how unusual is this kind of controversy? I mean, public art is often intended to provoke discussion, but this seems like it has caught folks by surprise.
Yes. So in my conversations with Seth and others, it seemed that most of the feedback was actually positive towards this mural. And this kind of negative backlash was in the minority. It was Phil and one other known member of the public who said some things during the mural's reception. But other than that, he's received mostly positive feedback with interpretations like, I feel comfortable to buy whatever furniture I want without judgment since it is on a furniture store, or interpretations like chill out, get outside of yourself, that sort of thing.
You also spoke to Lee Rowland, executive director of the National Coalition Against Censorship. What did Rowland tell you?
Yeah. So Rowland told me that basically it is very ironic that a mural kind of taking from this novel about censorship would get censored. And in addition to that, she said that she does not think the town really has a legal leg to stand on because previously the Supreme Court has ruled on court cases like this where a town has tried to sort of censor or take down a certain mural, claiming that it's signage code. And she said that the language in that Supreme Court case was actually very similar to this one. So she thinks because of that, they do not have a case.
And she also alleged that artist Seth Carnes' First Amendment rights might be violated.
Yes, that is correct. So this signage citation does not, according to Seth, does not apply to his artwork because it's artwork. It's not a sign. In his letter, in his team's letter in response to the defendants, he alleged that time to unperson is that's not just the whole artwork. You know, the font he used, the background, that's what makes it art. That's what makes it protected under VARA. So, yeah, that's basically what they're arguing there.
And has anyone changed their position since this all started over a year ago? Are folks, you know, changing how they view this?
No. So from who I've spoken to, Phil, I did speak with him, the main man that had this complaint. He had told me that he thought it was not needed, that it was divisive, vulgar. He did not really give me an explicit reason why. I think his interpretation of the novel that it came from was maybe different than what the artist intended. But from my knowledge, no one has changed their view on that.
And did you get any response from the town of Rockland or code enforcement officers there?
No, I did reach out, but I was not able to get comment, I assume, due to ongoing litigation.
And for Sunday Home, the building, the furniture store there, they're planning to get a new mural painted. Is that right?
Yes.
And what are they saying that mural might be about?
So that's still in the works. But I did ask them. They had told me, Paul had told me that he's talking with some artists. They're not sure yet. In the coming weeks, they'll know. But I did ask him, like, are we thinking typographical again? Are we thinking words? And he said, no, probably going to stray away from that. Maybe something that encourages peace and unity, something more contemporary.
And there is a crazy wall installation. Is that what they're calling this now? Or is there something different? What is crazy wall all about?
Yeah. So another installation that Seth has kind of been working on is this crazy wall installation that's in the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance right now. Basically what that is it's laid out like an evidence board, and it kind of covers this tangled web that he's in. There's court documents in there, there's articles, there's pictures of the formal mural, and that's kind of what's brought this whole mural situation back into discussion, is this new installation he has, which is actually going to be moving to New Memories in July. So that conversation is going to continue.
Yeah, that new art installation is at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance, and looking at it, it looks like something you would see when detectives are trying to solve a crime with all the different lines and pictures up on a bulletin board. That's Sonia Ahmed from the River Reporter talking to us about the latest in the controversy surrounding the Time to Unperson mural that was painted over in Roscoe. And this has been going on for a year or more now. And we'll continue to follow it along. You can read her reporting on this and more at riverreporter.com. Sonia, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll take you inside the museum at Bethel Woods, where a remarkable donation from Woodstock photographer Lisa Law is helping preserve the festival's history. It's Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, Dartmouth College President Sion Bailock.
We're not a political organization. We're not a social advocacy organization. We have a very clear mission. And when people trust in that mission, they trust you.
Can universities win back our trust? That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As Bethel Woods Center for the Arts celebrates its 20th anniversary, it's also looking ahead to the 60th anniversary of the Woodstock Music and Art Fair in 2029. A major donation from renowned Woodstock photographer Lisa Law is helping launch that effort with rare artifacts from the Hog Farm's Free Kitchen and the rights to use her iconic festival photographs for generations to come. Dr. Neil Hitch is senior curator at the museum at Bethel Woods, and he's here to tell us about what this important donation means for Bethel Woods and the celebrations and the milestones. Dr. Neil, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Tim.
It is a major donation. How does Lisa Law's donation fit into this 20th anniversary and this bigger milestone coming up, the 60th anniversary?
Yeah, it's crazy to think about that we are approaching the 60th anniversary of Woodstock.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think like a lot of people are starting to think, you know, it's been 60 years. Like, at what point, right? And so we've been working with Lisa. She came in 2023. We had this amazing, you know, kind of week with her. She has been a primary connector with our oral history initiative. We've been to Santa Fe 3 times, collected about 75 oral histories with people that attended the festival that she connected us with. But what she has done in the last few weeks is really, you know, what we call a legacy gift. And I think for Lisa, she's thinking, you know, how do we move this thing that I believed in so much, that I participated in, and that has been so much a part of my life? How do we leave that for generations to come? The core of this gift for me is that question about what comes next, like generations to come. Because as you well know, and everyone listening knows, like, things are changing so fast in how we consume media and information. And like, I can't even tell you what an exhibit is going to look like in 10 years, right? Like, I can guarantee you it's not going to be a poster on a wall.
Yeah.
That it's going to be something we might not even conceive of. And so a legacy gift like what Lisa has done with her photos is really a license to use these photos in ways that we haven't thought of, like people haven't thought of. this is like very unusual, but it's one of the things that we are really pursuing. We're calling it a legacy gift. It's how do we take this information that we've all lived with for nearly 60 years and we ensure that it's available in all of the formats that we will be consuming for the next 60 years.
I mentioned her work is iconic. Let's remind folks about Lisa Law and why her work is so significant.
Yeah, so Lisa Law was a photographer. She is an eye, right, for a great photo. She has done numerous album covers, but she's a great photographer because she was in great spaces. So from LA to Santa Fe to Woodstock, she just found herself in these spaces with things going around her, and she had a camera and she took pictures of it. So her pictures of the hog farm and the free kitchen by far are the best ones of the free kitchen. When she's there, right? She's just right there. But she also really captures some stuff that is very dynamic. The free kitchen is, you know, comes out of the spontaneous need to feed people at Woodstock. It becomes very clear on Thursday, August 14th, that there's a sheriff, Sullivan County Sheriff report that says the hog farm was, you know, expected to do 4,000 meals during the weekend, but they had done 4,000 meals by Thursday. Lisa gets $6,000. She goes into New York City. She buys hundreds of pounds of vegetables and oats and things. Comes back. They build the free kitchen. The free kitchen will serve over 200,000 meals during the weekend of Woodstock.
And she also, besides the photographs, donated physical artifacts from the Hogs Farm Free Kitchen. Why are those so meaningful? And are there particular items that you found especially moving or historically valuable?
So as much as I, you know, want to talk about the importance of like the photographs, right, and leaving this legacy that can be used in technology that we can't conceive of yet, also the stuff is really important, right? What she's been holding for 57 years are just some things that, again, we see in pictures, but they are the things there. One of the coolest things is she took video of going to New York. There's this whole story about buying these giant stock pots. They're making massive amount of vegetables in these stock pots over. And she had a story she told me just in June that in November of 1969, she had gone back to Santa Fe and she was at the hog farm and they were having a flea market, a sale, right? A garage sale. And one of the stock pots was there. And she bought the stock pot for the price of 5 chickens. She had to go back up to her farm, get 5 chickens, come back down and bought this stock pot. Now, she has exhibited this in numerous exhibits that she has held. She hosts this pop-up museum called the Museum of the 60s. So I know this stock pot and I've seen it, but I was in Santa Fe in June and she made arrangements for these donations and I brought the stock pot back. It is now sitting in the lobby of the museum. It's an amazing piece of history that is unbelievable to me that it was saved. The thing that's brilliant about kind of this collection, both with the artifacts and the photographs, is the photographs show the artifact and the artifact tells the story.
And with those photographs, are there particular Lisa Law photographs that reveal Woodstock that people may not see in the iconic images they're already familiar with? I mean, you kind of reference it here.
Yeah, I mean, one thing is it's the people processing food. She has pictures of that. So part of these donations, again, the stock pot, there's some cleavers that were bought in Chinatown in New York City. You know, there's a picture of people using those to chop up vegetables. In the museum, if you walk through, there's a video of Lisa, and she is saying, she went to local farms and she said, give me that row of carrots, give me that row of cabbage, give me that row of tomatoes. And, you know, it's kind of funny. And she's telling a story that's funny. When you listen to it, it's, you know, it's a feel-good story she tells. But when you look at these pictures, it's young people who are volunteering and they are cutting up vegetables to put in these pots to feed other young people who found themselves at a weekend where they had come with nothing and there's nothing available. Like, the free kitchen was the lifeline. It's one of the stories we forget about Woodstock. The myth we like to say is everyone ran out of food, but that's not true. They fed people at the free kitchen the entire time that people were here at the festival.
We mentioned that this is part of a broader effort to collect artifacts and personal stories ahead of Woodstock's 60th anniversary in 2029. As many folks who attended Woodstock are now in their 70s and 80s, there's a sense of urgency to, you know, connect with those people, with their oral histories and any of the other memories they want to share. Are there particular kinds of items that you're hoping people donate, or everyday objects sometimes just as valuable as like the headline making memorabilia?
Well, I'll tell you, we have a significant effort to collect clothing that was at Woodstock. We have about 205 pieces, actually, which is a lot if you think about it. But that is happening almost daily, that we are looking at working with people. Yesterday, somebody sent an email about clothing that they had, and we began making that connection. We are also doing oral histories in the museum now almost every day. This week, we had a day where we did three of them. It really is, there is a movement here for people to come back and do a pilgrimage. I call it, it's the one last pilgrimage for many of them. They're bringing their family members to show them where this iconic thing that happened, this defining moment of their life, that they're coming back to make sure that let their children know that the story that they've been saying every Thanksgiving, that's what I like, you know, it is real, right? The story is real.
This new exhibit opens Thursday, July 23rd?
Yeah, we are. So one of the things is Lisa will be here all weekend. We have at 1:30 on Thursday, we have a historic site tour with Lisa Law. It's on sale on the website. It's very limited tickets, but we will be going around the site with Lisa, talking about where she shot her photographs, talking about how she conceived of the free kitchen. We will be doing a docent tour of the museum on Friday. Friday is also our big celebration of the 20th anniversary of Bethel Woods. We have events and activities all day long. The Beach Boys will be playing. But from 10 to 2, the museum is free. We'll be doing this program with Lisa. We'll be doing historic site tours for $5, which those site tours are typically around $20 on a golf cart. Friday, we'll be doing them from 11 to 2 for $5.
If someone listening has photographs or letters or tickets or anything they want to share, what do you encourage them to do? How do they go about that?
Yeah, email museum@bethelwoodcenter.org, and a curator will reach out and begin a conversation.
I'm wondering, after spending so much time studying Woodstock and preserving Woodstock, what continues to surprise you or inspire you about this event nearly six decades later?
You know what I'm surprised at is it's a three-day festival. It's a three-day, very temporary festival plagued by rain and mud. I am amazed that anything survived, and almost daily we will get a call or an email, or somebody will stop in with something that you're like, how in the world did you save that thing? So that's the thing that surprises me, that anything is left really surprises me.
That's Dr. Neil Hitch, senior curator at the Museum at Bethel Woods. The 20th anniversary celebration is this Friday, the 24th. The Lisa Law exhibition, cannot say words, opens on Thursday. There's more information about all of it at BethelWoodsCenter.org. We should also mention that Bethel Woods is a financial supporter of Radio Catskill. Dr. Neil, thanks.
Thank you very much.
After the break, Mark Partridge joins us to preview The Dance Labyrinth, coming to Parksville, a free community event with DJs, live music, and visual art. This is Radio Catskill.
On the next Radio Lab,
these are like swimming fossils.
Could one of the oldest and scariest species on our planet,
sharks are crazy, yeah,
help cure some of our worst diseases?
It blows your mind. It really does.
These animals that we don't even want to share the water with because we're afraid that they'll harm us could actually save us.
Wait, what?
It's amazing, actually.
That's on the next Radio Lab. Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Nursing is the largest healthcare profession in the U.S., and it's growing. But only around 1 in 8 nurses are men. Still, that's double what it was a few decades ago.
Will we ever be 100% gender neutral? I don't know that. Can we help move the needle a little faster? Sure, there's opportunities for that.
I'm Elsa Chang, One School's effort to draw more men into nursing. On All Things Considered, from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. Well, if you're looking for a different kind of night out in the Catskills, one local DJ is inviting folks to leave their expectations at the door and simply dance. Mark Partridge, known as Ambient Barn here on Radio Catskill, is bringing his signature blend of eclectic music and community spirit back to new memories in Parksville for a dance labyrinth. Mark is joining us now. Good morning.
Hey, Tim. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Rainy day today.
Yeah, getting ready for a little Ambient Barn event called the Dance Labyrinth at New Memories in Parksville. What's that about for folks who haven't experienced it?
Yeah, so it is, you know, as you know, I like to put on some events throughout our region here that kind of draws attention to, you know, different kinds of electronic music, different kind of styles of electronic music, and been trying out this sort of, you know, variation on it where we're using some live drumming. So it's me and Julian Giamo, the incredibly talented Julian Giamo, which anybody in the music scene up here knows. Drummer, guitar player, runs a studio out of Cunyunga Lake. We teach together over at Bethel, and we were just talking one day, and, you know, we decided to kind of give it a shot. So we're throwing together, a set of just like, you know, hard dance floor songs, with, some live percussion on top of it. And we're encouraging people to kind of dress up in costume. And you know, the idea I think is to create this sort of like slightly disorienting experience space where you can kind of lose yourself and just dance for a few hours.
Yeah, the tagline is "Join us in the maze." What's the idea behind the labyrinth theme? Is it that just sense of losing yourself?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's this idea of like sort of losing yourself and kind of just like being in the moment and not sort of worrying about what the destination is or where you're going really, and just kind of like feeling yourself sort of drawn through this experience.
Ambient Barn, you developed quite a following here in the Catskills. Why do you think people are looking? What do you think people are looking for in these kinds of community dance experiences?
You know, I think like there's a lot of creative people up here. I think there's a lot of dancers up here. I think there's a lot of people who just want to go out and do cool things. And we're lucky enough to have places like New Memories that are just like open to hosting kind of experimental leaning events and just trying stuff out. You know, I mean, there's so many great DJs up here now kind of playing all over the county. And it just feels exciting. And it's kind of an honor to just be part of that group of people just bringing cool music to the Catskills.
You know, dance music events often focus on nightlife after hours, but your events seem to attract a broad mix of people. You've done the daytime disco. You've got different ideas about how to approach these dance events. How do you approach building a set that keeps people moving while also creating this sense of community and connection?
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, Dance Labyrinth starts at 7 p.m. You know, we're really trying to get to those folks who want to go out and want to dance and want to experience things, but don't really want to stay out that late, whether it's because, you know, they don't want to drink and drive or they're just tired, you know. You know, I think like dance and movement is, there's no like, there it shouldn't be gate kept by time, by, you know, alcohol, drugs, nothing. Like it should just be like an event that everybody should just be able to like attend and enjoy. So for this one, I think the idea was to sort of build a hypnotic first hour of music. So something that's kind of a little deep, a little hypnotic, with interesting percussion, which is definitely helped by having Julian on drums. So that's sort of the idea with this one, is to sort of build the early hour is kind of this like hypnotic trance state almost, and then kind of build up from there into, you know, kind of like the ecstatic portion of the night.
And there's some visual art installation as well going on?
Yeah, we're going to have some a bunch of projections kind of going on. I'm hoping we have 4 to 5 kind of just like thrown all around the room. Again, to sort of create an immersion, a feeling of immersion, a feeling of sort of being lost in a space. And hopefully this goes well, you know, and then we're going to try and replicate this idea again down the line. You know, all of these events are sort of like, they're almost like test kitchens. You know, you see what works, you see what people connect with, and hopefully this time is going to hit.
America's Dance Test Kitchen. I like it. Let's tell folks where they can get more information. And it's a free event, right?
Yeah, it's a free event, no cover. 7 p.m. New Memories. You can go to the New Memories page on Instagram, or you can go to the Ambient Bar page on Instagram. And you can follow me, follow them, and find out all of the relevant information.
And don't forget about Ambient Barn tonight at 9. That's music producer, sound designer, filmmaker Mark Partridge. He's also Ambient Barn, and the event is coming up at New Memories in Parksville. Thanks so much, Mark. Have a great time.
Yeah, thanks so much, Tim. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, still to come, the second weekend of the Weekend of Chamber Music. It's coming up next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Feel like you're just spinning in an endless whirlpool of information? We can help steady you. I'm Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, and we point out where you should be paying attention and what you can afford to ignore. Using the media as a lens on our world, we reveal nuance and detail often missed by other outlets. So don't miss On the Media, Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, 5 days in Palestine, we go all the way to the West Bank to ask this question: what drives Latino solidarity with Palestinians?
Connection to land has been my compass, especially seeing so many injustices in the world. How land is really at the root of it all.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
And that beautiful music you hear in the background is the cellist Carolyn Stinson, also the co-artistic director of the Weekend of Chamber Music, joined by the other co-artistic director, Andy Wagner, and our own classical Kit, back with more Weekend of Chamber Music. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
How was the first weekend of Weekend of Chamber Music? How did everything go last week? Yeah, the tornado warnings and everything. Yeah.
We did Carolyn, a concert in the dark.
Yeah. How did that go?
Well, it was fabulous. And everybody stayed. We had a wonderful audience. They sat in the dark and looked at the performers' faces lit up by iPads. And it was actually quite special. The only downside is we have no recordings or videos.
All right. We'll have to tell folks about it. Yeah. An oral history after this. But let's preview Kit, classical Kit. Let's talk more about what's coming up.
Yeah. So 3 things this week. Thursday night, Music Talks, which is going to be over at Nutshell Hall in Lake Huntington. And, you know, if listeners haven't experienced this before, you know, it's really very special because It's a conversation about the music with some music thrown in, kind of illustrating it. And everything this week is about the sound of period instruments. So you're continuing your My Brother's Keeper theme, but with very different kind of music to express that. And then Friday night, open rehearsal, which is one of my favorite things. You get to watch the collaboration that goes into creating a chamber music performance, which is essential because chamber music, there's no conductor. The musicians have to work it out among themselves. And then Saturday night, a wonderful performance coming up. So the open rehearsal and Saturday night are both at Catskill Art Space. So I want to ask a bit about the program. So you're going to open up Saturday night with a Bach Sinfonia from a cantata, which is, it's short and it's moving and it lets you hear how those instruments all sound together.
Yeah.
And that's a nice way to start.
It also sets the tone for the theme of this week's concert in general, which is compassion. And feeling compassion, empathy, desire for grace, feeling those things deeply, which is so central to Baroque music, not just sacred music, but secular as well, because Baroque music is all about moving the soul and putting the listener in a different emotional place just through the sounds that they're hearing. And so the Bach really takes us into that. And as you say, it's rather short. So it acts as this beautiful prelude to the rest of the program.
Yeah. And, you know, the next thing you're going to do is not all the Bieber Mystery Sonatas. I think there are 15 of them. Right. Plus Passacaglia, which I believe, tell me if I'm wrong, but didn't I hear Narit play that?
You did.
A few years ago?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think that was my introduction to Bieber.
Oh, yeah? So, yeah. Well, that's a good one.
Yeah. So, Carolyn, of all those various sonatas and everything, you know, did you help decide? Did you decide which you guys were going to play or...
Well, as a cellist, the Bieber sonatas are not works that I have a lot of experience with, right? And I really give really all the credit of anything that is not sort of a deeply connected work to the cello repertoire. That credit really goes to Andy. As a connoisseur of music, as a composer and as a listener, you know, he studies and investigates and lets curiosity and sort of lead the way, right? So he, as a violinist, knew the Bieber sonatas and as a composer was fascinated by them, but they're new to me as well. And just the arc that they create, these little miniature stories, each in and of itself, is a real adventure. So they are new to me as well.
But the Marin Marais, I mean, he's so famous for his compositions for the viol.
Absolutely.
Which I guess evolved into the cello.
Well, they have sort of separate lines a little bit. But but I remember vividly, I was a teenager when Tous les Matins du Monde, the movie with Jordi Savall, came out, and that soundtrack. And the Les Sonneries that we're playing is on the soundtrack to that movie. So it is embedded in my consciousness for sure. Yeah.
Well, so was there transcription involved in any of the things you're going to be playing?
I'm glad you mentioned that because when I first started working on the Marais, I thought, well, this is very strange, but I'm really going to make sure that I'm, you know, learning this well. And a couple of days went by before I realized that, no, what I was playing didn't make any sense. I'm actually have to play in three different clefs. And I just wasn't looking closely enough because they all look the same, but they're in slightly different places, right? So the viola da gamba plays in in many different clefs and has different tunings, right? Mm-hmm. And so it took me a little bit to realize that actually I have to make my own transcriptions. So I'm reading in clefs that I don't normally read in as a cellist, yeah.
And speaking of transcriptions, what about the Bach trio?
Well, the Bach, that's also a great question because that piece exists in two different forms, a sonata for viola da gamba and harpsichord, and then the trio sonata for two treble voices. So it's often done with two flutes.
Yeah, flutes.
Sometimes
is what I've
with violin
heard.
And flute, and we're doing it with two violins.
Uh-huh.
And then continuo, which is the Baroque rhythm section.
Right.
So if you think of a jazz ensemble, the rhythm section is piano, bass, and drums. And in Baroque music, it's cello or sometimes bassoon. Or sometimes violone, which is a big kind of bass-like instrument, and harpsichord. And this piece is just pure magic from start to finish. And really, it's interesting. We were talking after we did this program down in Durham, and the other music on the program is extremely intense emotionally and extremely concentrated and virtuosic and intensely dramatic. The Bach has a kind of serenity and a sense of completeness to it that makes it the perfect response to all of that earlier, much more intense music.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to hear them juxtaposed like that, because it can all, especially if you're a casual listener, Baroque music just seems kind of like Baroque music. You know, you could be forgiven for thinking that it all sounds quite a lot the same. But in this program, you realize just how incredibly varied it is.
Yeah. Well, I was listening to the Bieber, and it really was quite different, you know. Carolyn, you brought your cello, and we really want to hear it. So
this is what you, if this being radio, there are a couple of things that, of course, you can't see, one of which is that this cello has no end pin. So it's not resting on the floor. It's resting between Caroline's knees. It's also strung with old-fashioned gut strings. And it has quite a different sound. The bow also is very beautiful. It doesn't look like a modern bow. And it sounds like this.
It's always resonant, but that seems especially resonant. And I think, wasn't Bieber also known for like unusual ways of tuning?
Yeah. Yeah. Andy can speak a little bit more about that, but it, there are ways in which in Baroque music, the tuning and the resonance of not just the instruments itself, but also the space in which you're playing become a huge part of what we call the affect of how the music affects you, what the resonance space is, how we tune. We don't tune like we do with a piano.
Right.
Yeah, she's just almost a half step lower than she would be on a modern cello. And it is. It's extremely resonant. And so the Thursday night music talks, cleverly, is called Resonance Across Centuries, because that's one of the things that we're going to explore, is how the instruments resonate just on their own and then how they resonate together, which is part of the magic of period instruments.
Well, and I know that Andrus, who is joining you this year, is known for his improvisation. And so can we expect any improvisation Thursday night?
Thursday night, most certainly.
Okay. Yeah. I figured he would fit right in with the WCM All-Stars as someone who likes to improvise.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. So once again, we're looking at Thursday night music talks down at the Nutshell, and then open rehearsal Friday night at Cass. And then I also want to say there's the pre-concert talk at 6:30. The concert Saturday night is 7:30, but the pre-concert talk will make you appreciate everything you hear with so much depth, because it's just a deep dive into the music, and every time I come to one of those, I learn something new that answers questions I didn't even know I had.
So. Well, thank you. Well, every time I do one, I learn something new, so that's good too.
Andrew, let's remind folks where folks can get more information about the Weekend of Chamber Music performances coming up this week.
WCMconcerts.org.
And it looks like the forecast Thursday through Saturday is mostly sunny and nice. So fingers crossed. That's Andrew Wagner, Carolyn Stenson, co-artistic directors of the Weekend of Chamber Music, and our own Classical Kit. Before we go, we want to say congratulations to Classical Kit, who's just recently become a grandmother.
Thank you very much.
Very cute.
Beautiful baby. Beautiful little girl.
Thank you.
Weekend of Chamber Music is also a financial supporter of Radio Catskill. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
Wherever you go, take Radio Catskill with you. Stream your favorite shows, music, and podcasts anytime, anywhere with our new and improved app. Stay connected with local news and national headlines all in one place. You can even send us your thoughts with the Talk to Us feature, audio or video, right from your phone. No radio? No problem. Just press play. It's Radio Catskill right in your pocket. Download the app today on iPhone or Android.
This week on CatsCast, the running kind returns to the Catskills with a zero-carbon mountain race at Bel Air, pushing the limits sustainably.
As we get further down the line of dealing with different climate catastrophes and whatnot, it's the little things that matter, and we're using the trails. We should be stewards of the trails.
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, cloudy and humid, with a couple of showers and heavy thunderstorms moving through the area through this evening. Some of those storms could bring flooding, downpours, hail, damaging wind gusts, and potentially an isolated tornado. The National Weather Service has not issued any watches or warnings yet, though Orange County is under a flood watch. Those threats of heavy rain continue through this evening and into tomorrow morning. Today's high 73, tonight's low 65. That afternoon shower could become to us again tomorrow afternoon. Sorry, a high 77. Then it looks like we're turning to mostly sunny, less humid skies and temperatures for the rest of the week through the weekend, with highs in the mid to upper 70s. On Point is coming up next. Don't forget to download the Radio Catskill app for Android or iPhone and listen to Radio Catskill wherever you are.
This week on This American Life.
I just think we're opening a whole can of worms here that we don't want to be.
To better understand testosterone and its effects, I and the staff of the radio show get our testosterone levels checked to see who has the most.
For the men, I think it'll be a big deal. You'll know when you're talking to each other who beat you. I think it'll change everything.
This whole thing is going to lead to heartbreak.
Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.